men that surrounded me. They were the same veterans who had accosted me back on Earth. My knife made a sweeping motion, and they hastily withdrew their hands. I slashed my bonds and sat up on my bunk. "You boys really should let a man know when you're going to pull a stunt like this," I said. "Somebody might get hurt." Harris put his big face into mine. "You're coming with us, candidate."
"Sure thing, vet. Lead the way."
They retreated from my bunk while I got to my feet, stretched, and pulled on my clothes. As none of them were wearing armor, I didn't bother to put on mine either. They led me to Green Deck, and we followed the stream that wound through the middle of the forested section. The stream terminated and spilled into a tiny artificial canyon, forming a waterfall. We walked down a path to the bottom of the canyon. Overhead, I could see stars sliding gently by through the simulated glass dome. I could tell that the stars had shifted since the last time I'd looked at them with Della some hours ago. The pinpoints of white light moved with almost imperceptible slowness, like the hands of a clock. We reached the end of the path and stood at the sandy bottom of the canyon. I spotted a group of several other candidates. Their heads were in sacks, and they lay on their bellies with their wrists tied to their ankles. Each of them was trussed up like a Christmas turkey.
"Oh, I get it," I said. "I was supposed to be tied up, wasn't I?"
One of the veterans stepped up to me angrily. I recognized him in the starlight. He was none other than Veteran Johnson of 1st Platoon.
"You're mocking us, aren't you?" he demanded.
"Why, no, vet," I said. "Whatever gave you that idea?"
I knew I shouldn't do it, but I gave him a little grin.
"Settle down, Johnson," said Harris. "You'll get your chance."
Johnson never even looked at Harris. He kept eyeing me instead.
"You know what would make me happy, McGill?"
I glanced down at his hands. Sure enough, one of his two gloves looked half empty. I realized then that he'd drawn the short straw a second time while dealing with me.
"Let me guess," I said. "A couple of extra fingers?"
He threw a punch at me, which I ducked. He caught a little bit of my left ear, but it was no big deal. Harris was between us instantly. He pushed us apart and shoved his face into each of ours.
"We're doing this one by the book," he said. "You hear me?"
"Loud and clear, vet," I said.
My eyes never left Johnson's. We stared each other down for about two more seconds before backing off.
"McGill,"
Harris asked in a sarcastic tone,
"would you mind going over there and standing with the rest of the candidates?"
I did as he asked. Moments later, the veterans slashed their captives free. I looked from one face to the next in the starlight. Two of them I recognized. One was none other than Weaponeer Sargon. The other was a short, stocky woman built like a fireplug. She was from 1st Platoon, but I couldn't remember her name.
"Here's the deal," Harris said. "All of you have been advanced to candidacy, but only one of you will be given the promotion. As the existing veterans of 3rd Unit, it's our job to watch and judge this contest. Your boundaries are the walls of this canyon. Do not exit the boundaries. To do so will result in immediate disqualification."
As he spoke, I began to frown. It was dawning on me that this was some kind of arena combat scenario. The other candidates were already eyeing each other and separating. I took this time to examine my surroundings more closely. We stood on a beach that was only about 10 meters wide. The canyon was circular and about 100 meters across. The walls were quite forbidding. They were sheer and vertical. The only easy path out of the canyon was the foot trail we'd come down on, which wound its way up along the walls and under a waterfall at the far end. I'd gone swimming down here a number of times in the small, cool, deep lake that formed the center of the canyon.
"Oh," Harris said. "One more thing, McGill. Would you be so kind as to give me your weapon?"
"You mean my knife?"
"Exactly."
I drew it out, flipped the blade so that I held the tip and flicked it at him. He flinched, but he didn't jump out of the way. The blade stuck in the sand between his boots. Smiling grimly, Harris picked up the knife.
"The last man or woman who's left alive in this canyon tonight is a veteran. That's it, no more rules. Go.
The fireplug woman moved first. She caught Sargon by one foot and pulled backwards. He went down on his face, growling. A thin, rat-faced man joined her. Together, they dragged Sargon out into the water. I thought about intervening, but I didn't have time to see how that struggle ended. Something hit me, blindsiding me, knocking me back into the water. A dark figure loomed over me, outlined by the stars. He had a big rock in both his hands and a snarl on his face. I fought to get my hands in between that rock and my skull. He still managed to deliver a glancing blow, and I could feel the blood leaking out of my scalp. The veterans were cheering. They called out encouragement, catcalls, and slammed their hands together in applause when someone landed a hard blow. The guy with the rock kept coming after me. Feeling a little dazed, I decided to disengage. I swam away with long strokes toward the center of the lake. The guy with the rock didn't follow. Instead, he ran off toward the foliage along the shoreline. The fireplug woman with her rat-faced companion managed to drown Sargon. There was nothing I could do, and it made me angry. They'd teamed up plain as day. That seemed unfair. I could only wonder if they'd known ahead of time how this trial was going to go. I hadn't seen them talk or negotiate anything in the canyon. I could only surmise that they'd been in cahoots from the start.
"Well played! Well played,"
Harris said, talking to the fireplug and her sidekick.
"I feel compelled to reward success."
So saying, he produced my combat knife and tossed it at the feet of the woman. Both she and her partner lunged for the knife. I treaded water, watching.
"What's this?" Harris chuckled. "Treachery! So soon!"
The stout woman had landed on the knife first, with Rat Face on her back a fraction of a second later. Four hands clamped onto the hilt of one knife. They rolled, grunting, but in the end the rat found his throat slashed, and the woman stood over him panting. More applause, appreciative shouts.
"Come on, McGill!" Johnson shouted at me. "Quit hiding out there in the lake!"
I turned and swam for the waterfall.
"Well, now," Harris said. "That's just plain cowardice, McGill."
Harris drew his sidearm, an old gunpowder weapon, and shook all the cartridges out of the gun except for one. He threw the weapon at the guy who'd hit me with the rock.
"Here, catch!"
Any one of my teachers from Atlanta's primary education system could have told you years back that I'd never been the most attentive student. But even I, when faced with overwhelming evidence, can figure out where the cards lay. These veterans had no intention of letting me win this contest. In fact, it looked to me like they were going to cheat if they had to. No matter what, I was destined to lose. They'd probably set up the fireplug and her rat buddy to nail Sargon right off, so I wouldn't have anyone to team with. Seeing that there was a gun in play, the fireplug lady ran off around the lake to the far side. Grinning, the dark-complected, squatty-looking man with Harris's gun circled the other way. I could tell he wasn't interested in taking his single shot at long range. He wanted to get in close and make sure of a kill. Both of them headed toward the waterfall on opposite sides of the lake. I came up under the waterfall, breathing hard. I could see two figures approaching through the mist, one from either direction. This gave me an idea. If they could cheat, why couldn't I? I dove, swimming deep into the cold water. I took long, sweeping strokes. I was well below the surface. Each pumping motion of my arms and legs took me back toward the shoreline where this had all started. When I surfaced, gasping, it was just in time to hear a shot crack in the air. The veterans whooped. They were standing knee-deep in the lake around me. I stood up in the water. Johnson was the man nearest me. His luck was consistent.
"What the hell?" he shouted. "McGill, all you do is run from the fight. You have to be the biggest chicken."
That was as far as he got. I stepped up to him, pulled his sidearm out of his holster, and aimed over his shoulder. I shot veteran Gonzalez, who had just turned in our direction to see what the fuss was about. My surprised target went down on his face with a loud splash. The back of his skull was gone. Johnson began struggling with me, but as he was missing a finger or two, he couldn't stop my hand from bringing his gun around and placing the muzzle against his chest. Boom! I don't think Johnson could believe his bad luck right to the end. He stared up at me as he was dying, even after the lake water covered his face. Harris slammed into me a moment later. The pistol flew out of my grasp. We traded blows for long seconds. I knew the game might be up. I was getting tired, and my head injury from the guy with the rock was throbbing. Hell, I'd have been lucky to beat Harris one-on-one when I was fresh. Harris snatched the fallen gun out of the water. He aimed it at me, his sides heaving with exertion.
"God damn it!" Harris roared. "How is it, McGill, that every time..."
Harris made a choking sound. I saw the squatty little guy who'd smashed me with a rock minutes ago. He'd snuck up behind Harris and rammed my knife home. He must have taken it from the woman candidate after having shot her. Not to be taken out so easily, Harris turned, ripped the knife out of his own back, and ran down his attacker with it. I followed at a safe distance to watch what transpired with morbid curiosity. Harris cut the man to ribbons with my knife. All the while, he bled profusely and released a steady stream of profanity. Harris turned to face me at last. His sides were heaving, and his body was slick with sweat and blood.
"Whatever possessed you to attack your superiors yet again, McGill?"
he asked me in a hoarse voice.
"You have to know you're disqualified now."
"Well, that," I said, "I guess I just didn't understand this contest from the beginning."
Harris began laughing. It was a hitching, gasping, gargling sound. He shook his head and sighed.
"You're a real piece of work. You know that, boy?"
"Yeah, I guess I do."
Harris slumped forward. He looked surprised, like he was going to vomit or something. Then he slipped onto his face in the water. A few last bubbling, bloody snorts came out of him. Then he died. It was blood loss that had done the trick, if I had to guess. Uncertain as to where this left matters, I retrieved my knife, wiped it clean, and walked up the path. When I got to the top, I was met by four officers, Centurion Graves, Adjunct Leeson, Adjunct Toro, and Adjunct Mesa. We're all standing up there together. I realized they must have watched the trial from the edge of the cliff surrounding the canyon. Swaying a bit, I saluted the group.
"Specialist McGill reporting, sirs."
"Don't you mean Veteran McGill?" asked Adjunct Leeson.
"That's ridiculous," Adjunct Toro snapped. Her face was red, and her teeth were clenched in anger. "McGill didn't follow instructions."
"Hell," Leeson said. "He never does that."
"Well, I vote that he be disqualified," Toro said.
She'd never liked me much, so I wasn't surprised. Graves turned toward the last adjunct.
"What do you think, Mesa?"
Mesa looked me over like he smelled bad meat.
"I don't think I want this man as a veteran in our unit," he said.
My heart sank, but I stood there resolute. If they were going to kick me back to specialist, I wasn't going to cry and whine about it. Sure, the game had been rigged. There'd been no way I could win outright with the vets distributing weapons to the other contestants, but complaints weren't going to convince anyone to change their verdict. Graves shook his head thoughtfully.
"I'm afraid I'm going to have to overrule the majority of my adjuncts in this instance,"
he said.
"For me, the deciding factor came to light when the last candidate attacked Harris. It was apparent through that action that he believed the fight to the death announced by Harris included the veterans themselves."
"Not so," Adjunct Toro piped up again. "All that proves is that McGill's bizarre actions confused everyone."
Graves shrugged. "You've got a valid complaint. But the fact is, and you can check the vid recordings to back this up, Harris did say the last man to walk out of that canyon alive would be a veteran. He did not specify that the veterans themselves were not participants. I don't think any of you can argue that McGill isn't the last man standing."
The two who had voted against me grumbled but didn't say anything else.
"McGill,"
Graves asked, turning to me,
"what have you got to say for yourself?"
"Well, sir," I said, "you described the situation pretty well. Harris inserted himself into the contest when he began to distribute weapons at random to the candidates. At least that's how I saw it." Graves nodded.
"Very well.
As far as I'm concerned, you're our newest man with the honorable rank of veteran. Congratulations. He reached out a gloved hand, and I shook it. Just like that, I'd achieved a new rank. I knew there would be no love lost between Harris, myself, and the rest of the non-coms, but I didn't much care. They'd never been too sweet on me to begin with. Chapter 10. I found my new rank to be a little bit daunting. Sure, I was far from a rookie, but I knew there were soldiers with more experience than I had in this unit. They looked at me with a strange mixture of jealousy, curiosity, and maybe, just maybe, a hint of respect. It was the last item on the list that worried me. I had to earn that respect in order to keep it. I had to prove myself worthy of it. Yes, I'd pulled a fast one during a simulated battle with the dragons from Dust World, but that was a far cry from leading a squad throughout a campaign on an unknown planet. One of the nice things about my new position was the command structure the auxiliary cohort had embraced. Rather than being made up of infantry with units led by centurions with the strength of 120 men each, Winslade's cohort was more limited in size. We were considered to be cavalry. Each squad was led by a veteran like me. The squads were broken up into two maniples of five troops each, just like the Roman cavalry of ancient times. One of the maniples was led by a specialist, making him second in command, while the other was led by the veteran directly. That meant each squad was made up of an even dozen riders and their dragons. The specialists, placed in charge of a maniple, were mostly weaponeers, but there were also a number of bios and techs in the mix. Because all of us were outfitted with large, walking fighting machines, we didn't have as much need for our traditional infantry-oriented roles. I was a little sorrowful I wasn't going to be carrying a belcher into battle this time, but I got over it quickly the more I worked with the dragons. They were quite obviously superior weapon systems. Harris took the other squad in our platoon, and Leeson commanded above him. Although I was effectively just one more trooper piloting a dragon, the difference this time was I'd been placed in charge of 11 other guys riding along behind me. A little over a third of the infantry who tried out qualified on the dragons, and I was proud to note that almost everyone in 3rd Unit had survived the winnowing process. That was due in large part to our success with the initiation trials on the rooftop battlefield. Most units had been slaughtered. In fact, my group was given the grim task of annihilating the last units to come over from Minotaur to kick off their training. I wasn't proud of it, and the butchery was intense. But I had to admit afterward that it was a valuable lesson to both sides. No trooper could fail to appreciate the power of a dragon after being killed by one. Their pilots working the controls were undeniably impressed as well. The troops that performed badly during the training exercises were sent back to Minotaur to fill out other ranks as needed. Once we were down to the best of the best, the training commenced in earnest. During a period of about 3 weeks, we trained hard every day. In all that time, veteran Harris never spoke to me. In fact, he did his damnedest not even to look at me. I understood. After all, I'd made a fool out of him and the other veterans in my unit. That wouldn't sit well with anyone. Della and I had lunched together a few times over the weeks following our first encounter, but I'd made sure things didn't go any further than that. If she was married, I was determined to respect her vows, even if she didn't. During my 4th week aboard Cyclops, the brass announced that the target star system directly ahead of our 3 ships was now easy to see with the naked eye. This wasn't exactly true as we were in a warp bubble and vision was interpolated, but it was still an exciting change. Going up to the observation deck the night before we arrived at Gamma Pavonis, I sat quietly with many others and watched the white star grow fractionally larger every hour. Keevy joined me that night as I maintained my vigil.
"James," she asked, "are you up here by yourself?"
I made a vague waving gesture toward the numerous couples that surrounded us.
The observation deck on any warship tended to attract people who wanted romance, if not privacy. They lined the walls up against the curving hull, because the couches arrayed there were darker than those in the center. That left me with a big central couch. "I'm hardly by myself," I said, smiling. Kiwi smiled back.
"You know what I mean?"
"Yeah, you're right. I don't seem to be as popular with the ladies this time out." Kiwi cocked her head and looked at me curiously.
"That's not what I hear?"
I shrugged. I turned to examine the white star again. Was it a pixel or two larger now? Maybe.
"Depression?" Kiwi asked. "Can this be for real?"
Chuckling quietly, I shook my head. I'd hardly call it that. Can a man question his place in the universe without people thinking there's something wrong with him?
No, they can't. At least not in your case. Other people can be self-possessed and introspective, but not James McGill. I have to admit I'm curious as to the cause of your unprecedented mood. Let me guess, it has something to do with Natasha and Della? Am I right?
Maybe. Kiwi climbed onto my couch without asking. She scooted across until she bumped her hip into mine.
"Oh, yes," she said. "The view from here is much better. Now tell an old girlfriend what this is all about."
"What if I don't want to?"
"Then I'll have to guess."
I shrugged. "Go for it."
"Okay, let's see. Natasha always has believed deep down that you're her private property. And Della, well, that girl is just plain crazy. I can see plenty of ways that a man might get caught between those two and yet shut out by both."
I liked Kiwi, and I liked how she felt all warm and vital lying there next to me. But her words were starting to make me feel a little uncomfortable. I squirmed a bit. I couldn't help it.
"What's wrong?" she demanded. "The McGill I know would have grabbed me by now. Oh, my God."
Frowning, I turned to look at her. Her eyes were wide, and they searched mine intently.
"It's true, isn't it?"
she asked.
"What's true?" "I'd heard rumors. Someone told me Della is pregnant. It's got to be something like that. The James McGill I've always known would have moved on by now to find another girl, if it was anything less."
I shook my head and smiled ruefully. "Wrong," I said. "She's not pregnant. She already had the baby." Kiwi's mouth fell open, comically wide. She punched me then, right in the gut. I grunted and grabbed her small fist before she could do it again.
"What kind of an asshole are you, James?" she demanded in a harsh whisper.
Her mood had shifted as quickly as an autumn wind, but that was Kiwi for you. "Why are people always asking me that?" I wondered aloud. She scooted away from me about a foot and crossed her arms over her ample breasts.
"So," she said, "let me guess how this happened. Back on Dust World, you met Della, screwed her, and left her there. Now, she's out here in space trying to make a living, training our legions to use these dragons, while your kid is back on Dust World growing up alone."
"You make it sound like I did this as part of some kind of evil plan." "Well, I didn't. She was the one who wanted to get pregnant. She chased me on Dust World for that express purpose. Now I find out I've got a kid, and I don't quite know what to do about it." Kiwi was quiet for maybe 10 seconds. To be honest with you, it was kind of nice.
"It was her idea?"
she asked suddenly.
"The getting pregnant part, I mean?"
"Yeah, sure. Think about it. Those colonists were living separated from Earth, with a limited gene pool. To their way of thinking, procreating with new humans was almost a duty." Kiwi nodded thoughtfully. She scooted back toward me and threw one leg over mine. I jumped a bit reflexively, not quite knowing where she was going with this. But then she kissed me, and I figured it out. The winds had shifted back the other way. We made out on the observation deck as I hadn't done for years. Kiwi, as I've said before, is not a shy girl. Even though we were in semi-darkness,
I didn't quite feel comfortable with some of the things she did while climbing over me on that couch. But it had been a while since I'd made love to a woman, so I let her open our tops and kiss me passionately. At one point, I heard someone giggling off to my left. I put a gentle hand on Kiwi's cheek and lifted her face away from my neck. How about we go someplace else?
Screw them, she said hotly. It's nothing they haven't seen before.
Yeah, well, we're giving them a live show here. She made a frustrated sound and hopped off the couch. She tugged on my hand until I followed her. There were more whispers and giggles from the dark around us as we left the observation deck. I figured she would want to go to Green Deck, but we didn't make it that far. When Kiwi gets hot, she gets really hot. We made love in an ammo storage compartment. The metal containers were unevenly surfaced cold planes against bare skin, but Kiwi didn't seem to care. After a while, neither did I. Chapter 11. When we arrived at Gamma Pavonis, we came down directly above the local plane of the ecliptic. In other words, instead of moving from one planet to the next, getting closer and closer to the central star, we dove straight down toward the target world's northern pole. It was no secret we were coming. Three Imperial capital ships, dreadnoughts all, can't hide on approach. Once we turned off the Alcubierre drive and transformed from glowing blue-white spheres of light into what looked like a trio of comets with 100-kilometer-long plumes of exhaust, any alien watching the scene would have to be blind not to know what was coming next. The good news was that they couldn't have detected us until we came out of our warp bubbles. As I understood it from the text, we were technically visible as a bubble of light while the drive was active, but since the effect was moving faster than the speed of light in relative terms, there was no time for the light thus produced to reach the eyes of anyone watching. We were effectively outrunning our own shadows. But once we turned off the big drives, well, that was it. There isn't much in space to occlude the view of a sensor, and any kind of traditional engine produces heat, light, and other energy readings that were very visible. I wasn't sure what kind of sensors the squids might have, but I was pretty sure they knew we were coming in hot. About the squids, I had no doubt that they were at least watching this system. If both the Empire and their kingdom were interested, they had to have a survey team out here at the very least. I said as much to Natasha, who gave me a look, then sighed and answered civilly.
You're right, she said. You've got to be right if you think about it. They will have seeded this system with sensors and listening posts. We only hope that they didn't...
That was as far as she got. An alarm went off. It wasn't a ship-wide klaxon, but it was a flashing yellow-orange bar on her tapper. She looked at it, then glanced at me in alarm.
I've got to go, she said.
What's wrong?
They're summoning all the techs to battle stations.
She looked scared, and I didn't blame her.
What's going on?
I asked her. Should we be preparing for action?
I don't know. Follow your tapper and the arrows on the deck. You know the drill.
She turned to go, but I put a hand on her shoulder. I gave her a hug. No kiss, no rude squeezes, just a friendly hug. After stiffening up for a second, she relaxed, hugged me back, and wished me luck. She left, smiling. I watched her race off down the passage toward the weapons deck. There were arrows now, just like she'd said. Green ones meant tech only. Those lit up first and stayed lit, glowing on the deck plates. As I walked farther down the passage and ramps, the red arrows lit up. Red indicated combat arms, which meant me. I watched, but the other colors stayed dark. Blue was for bios in case of a medical emergency. Golden arrows meant everyone should follow them, and they were usually reserved for abandoning the ship. The way shipboard actions worked on an Imperial vessel was, well, odd. The Skrull, who crewed the ships, weren't allowed to fire the weapon systems. In Frontier 921, only humans were licensed, literally, to fight in star systems beyond their own. Because of this, a tech like Natasha was invaluable. She had the skills required to run the ship's sensors and operate the broadsides in a battle.
Natasha herself was not part of my dragon-riding squad. She'd failed to impress the brass while operating a combat machine. She just didn't have the killer instinct, or at least not enough of it, to satisfy Graves and the rest. But she was a good tech. So they decided to keep her aboard Cyclops to operate the guns if we needed them. Watching Natasha vanish around a corner, I decided not to wait around for the brass to deploy us. I knew the battle decisions were being made right here aboard Cyclops. Of the three ships, this one had the smallest complement of troops, as it only housed the cavalry. For that reason, Turov had brought her command staff here and had taken over Gold Deck, making it her operations center for the entire task force. Knowing my fate was being decided by staffers up on Gold Deck didn't make me happy. Sometimes it seemed like the officers treated us like hamsters in cages. They ignored us until it was time to give us orders, then provided arrows and instructions a moron could follow. They only noticed failure after that, or that we weren't moving fast enough. I trotted after the red arrows to my squadron's prep room. We didn't have a formal service deck, not yet, but we had our own section of the module with bunks all around and a row of tough polymer crates that enclosed our dragons. "All right, listen up," I shouted, slamming my hands together. It was gratifying to see troops hop off their bunks and gather around. Even Carlos hustled. And when I had everyone's attention, I went into my routine. "We're going to prep up like this is a hot action. We haven't gotten the official call yet, so don't wet your pants, but who knows? It could come at any time."
"Is this a boarding action, Vet?"
demanded Carlos excitedly. I smiled. "We can only hope. I would like nothing better than to meet up with a pack of squids while riding these sweet machines." The others echoed my sentiments. We'd been training for more than a month, and we were itching to try out our new equipment on an honest-to-God enemy. We dressed in thin smart suits not unlike those I'd worn as a light trooper. They were vacuum-tight in a pinch, but really it was like wearing a garbage bag. If our dragons failed us, we'd probably die fast. Opening up the crates, we coaxed out our machines and climbed over them, checking gauges, and wham! A tremendous sound rang through the ship. I knew that sound. There was only one thing that could have caused it. "Broadsides are fired," I shouted. "Be on your toes, we must be in fleet action."
"This is bullshit,"
Carlos said, picking himself up and trying to get his machine into a squatting stance for mounting.
"They should tell us what's going on."
"If we need to know something, we'll be told," I said firmly with a conviction that I didn't feel. I knew from long association with the legions that the brass was perfectly capable of forgetting about ground troops in the belly of a transport. In fact, if they figured it would be easier to let us all die and be revived later, they might well engineer our deaths for the sheer convenience of it. But I was a veteran now. I wasn't supposed to whine or complain. I was supposed to reassure those who did. It felt a little odd, but I thought I could get used to it. Finally, someone felt the urge to tell us what the hell was going on outside our ship's hull. A voice and a face appeared on one wall. It was none other than Primus Winslade.
"Troops," he said, looking a little flustered. "Cyclops, Minotaur, and Pegasus are in action. We've met up with unexpected resistance. There appears to be some kind of fortification on the smallest of the target world's three moons. The moment we exited warp and showed ourselves, this moon fired missiles at us. They're currently inbound. Everyone is to prep their equipment and march to the lifters. I want my cohort off this ship and in transit now."
Winslade sounded nervous. He didn't say how many missiles or what kind of warheads they had. He probably didn't know. Carlos slapped my shoulder.
"Hey, you do realize what's going to happen if those missiles get through our defenses and blow up one of these ships. That's it. Permed. A whole legion. Or maybe it will be our lucky turn to get cleaned out. After all this training, too. I want—"
"Shut up, Ortiz," I boomed. I realized I should have said those words about a full minute back, but I was a little slow sometimes. I wasn't used to being the veteran.
"Get your rig walking, with you inside of it."
Everyone went back to prepping their machines. About 90 seconds later, I rolled up the big bay exit door, and we went clanking down the passageway toward the lifters. Red arrows lit up the floor. That was us, combat arms. I hope they'd load up the rest of our support people, too. We needed everything on this drop. I didn't even bother to look back to see if the rest of the dragons were following me. If they weren't stomping after me with their tails lashing, well, they could die in the module with the bio people. Wham! The broadsides had fired another salvo. I was nearly thrown off my artificial feet. Servos whined, and I drew a three-clawed gash on the closest metal wall. But I stayed up and marching. My team was behind me, and I could see there were no stragglers. My HUD showed they were all there, a row of wicked marching machines right behind me. Among all the squads to reach the lifters, we were third. I felt proud. Veteran Harris was there ahead of me, however. He gave my team a glance but didn't nod or wave. He looked like he smelled something foul. Leeson waved me closer. He was inside one of the dragons as well. His claw arm looked strange as he made a human-like gesture. I hurried and clanked up to him. "Good job, McGill," he said. "You're right on time. We'll be the first lifter to abandon this ship if Toro's platoon gets down here." Graves came clanking in next. I thought he looked uncomfortable in his dragon. He didn't ride it, it rode him. "This damn thing fell on its nose when the broadsides fired the second time," he complained. "Where the hell is Toro?" Leeson threw up his grippers. "She's late." The broadsides boomed a third time, and about 1 second later, Toro and her team arrived. She was leading all of them with her two veterans right behind her. I recognized Johnson and Gonzalez. I wondered how glad they were to lay eyes on me.
"About time, Toro," Graves said. "Get your machine secured. We're dropping."
"Sir," Leeson said. "The pilot wants to know if we can fly. The missiles, sir."
"Tell him to decouple in 20 seconds. Positions, everyone."
We dropped our visors all around, and we backed our machines into the hanging clamps that were supposed to secure us during flight. Moments later, the floor became a wall, and then it became the ceiling. About half of Toro's group wasn't ready. Their machines went sliding and crashing across the deck, slamming in a pile up against the hull 100 meters down. Some managed to grab onto things with their grippers, and a crewman was crushed.
"Toro, damn it!" Graves fumed. "Get your people under control."
"We must be in trouble out there," Leeson said, grunting and hanging onto his clamps with his grippers. "What's the word from Winslade?"
"There isn't any," Graves answered.
I noticed Leeson hadn't moved an inch during the inversion. He was using his grippers to hang on like they were arms. He instinctively hadn't trusted his clamps. I thought that was a pretty good idea and privately ordered my squad to do the same. Pretty soon, every machine in sight was hanging on for dear life. The lifter righted itself after about a minute. We pulled hard G's during a slewing turn. Then there came that undeniable feeling of falling at high speed. My stomach was in my mouth and my heart was pounding in my ears. Could Cyclops have been hit? What about Natasha and the rest? I didn't know anything except that I was about to land on an alien world I hadn't even had the time to lay eyes on yet.
"Hey, McGill," Carlos said. "I'm sorry, I mean Vet. Look at this stream. I'll pipe it to your tapper."
He sent me a streaming feed. Lord only knew how he'd gotten access to it. The image was grainy, and it skipped and fuzzed out now and then, but the scene was unmistakable. 3 ships hung over a gray-white mist-clad world. Distantly, a moon of dark rock floated. It was covered in puffing explosions. Were those our strikes, or more missiles firing up from the moon base? It was hard to tell, but I figured it was our own broadside shell slamming home. I'd seen them strike before, and the power was daunting. Whatever missile base was firing on us was sure to be toast, with 3 of these ships hammering at it. The one worrying thing, however, was displayed as the view shifted. I realized then that the vid was from someone aboard our lifter. Probably a tech who'd released a buzzer and had it fly to a porthole. Buzzers were insect-sized drones that were often used for scouting or even spying by Legion techs. One of the 3 capital ships was on fire. It was Pegasus, Solstice Legion's transport. Normally fire wasn't possible in space, but with the released oxygen escaping with other gases, she was a briefly lit torch. She'd been hit. Hit bad. My heart sank to see that. Out of the bottom of Pegasus' tiny capsules were firing like bullets. Hundreds of them shot out as the ship was bombarding the planet below. I knew those capsules didn't contain explosives. They were carrying troops. Each one was a drop pod firing down through the atmosphere into the murky clouds of this new world. My heart went out to the Solstice Legionnaires. What a way to enter a war. There was no way they'd reached their optimal drop altitude. The Legion commanders had to be panicking to order a general drop from such a height, trying to save their... That's the point I'd reached in my thoughts when Pegasus exploded. I closed my eyes and said a silent prayer for the thousands that still had to be aboard her. Chapter 12. I've been to war in 3 star systems over the years, with Gamma Pavonis being my 4th deployment. That doesn't make me some kind of grizzled old-timer, but it does mean I've been around the bush a few times. I could tell already, this campaign felt different. In the past, there'd always been a certain degree of restraint. There'd always been orderly rules applied, to some degree, to each battle I'd witnessed. Hiring out as mercenaries to various planets with internal problems, one never knew when things might get hairy. But there were certain things you could trust would or would not happen. One such rule was the sanctity of Empire ships. No one, I mean no one, fired on Imperial warships. To do so not only meant your own destruction, but very likely would result in the destruction of your entire species. I found myself commiserating with some of the old-time European generals. This must have been how it had felt for them when they met enemy troops who didn't line up in colorful costumes and fire their guns all at once. There was no sense of honor or reticence in these aliens. They meant to kill us all. They didn't care about our contracts, our revival machines, or the consequences of their actions. They meant to kick our collective asses any way they could. To me, the fact the enemy had destroyed Pegasus indicated that we were engaged with the squids. These guys might not have spines, but they had balls. They didn't care 2 hoots about Imperial might or the threat of eventual annihilation. This was war of a different caliber entirely. All-out war. A total war. Taking a deep breath, I cut Carlos's feed to my tapper when we hit the upper atmosphere. I couldn't see anything but white clouds after that anyway. We hit a patch of turbulence right off and it kept getting worse as we went down. Whatever this atmosphere was made of, it was thick. The vapor never broke, from the mesosphere on down to the troposphere. We were bouncing and thumping every kilometer of the way down to the surface, and more than a few of my troops puked. "Shut those visors the second you're done throwing up," I ordered. "You never know when we'll take a hit and lose pressure."
"Permission to get out of my dragon, sir?"
Carlos asked. He toppled over onto his nose and was having trouble getting up. Servos whined and his claws gouged the metal of the ship's floor. "Permission denied," I said, clanking over to him. I threw out my grippers and caught hold of his tail, which was whipping around, trying to get him back into balance. I hauled him up onto his hind legs and clanked away. "Hold on to something, anything," I told them. "I'll try to get a weather report from the techs." As a veteran, I was now permitted to log into command chat and listen in. It would have been considered bad manners by my officers if I said anything, so I kept quiet. On the inside of my helmet, the names of the speakers lit up in green when they spoke. That was helpful because a lot of the transmissions were sketchy. Winslade's ID flashed up first.
"What's your status, Graves? Give me a count of effectives."
"We're at full capacity, sir," Graves responded. 4th unit is on the same lifter with us, and I think they're as ready and able as we are."
"No casualties?"
"No, sir. My unit was on the first lifter out of the ship. We didn't take any flak."
Winslade chuckled unpleasantly.
"That figures. Your team is made up of the fastest rats in this part of the galaxy."
I wanted to jump in and yell at Winslade, but I held my tongue. We'd followed our orders, that's all. If we moved fast, it was because we'd been prepared, not because we were chickens.
"What are your orders, Primus?" asked Graves.
Looks like you'll be on the first lifter down. Spread out and secure the LZ for the rest. Report back any resistance or hazards encountered. Winds laid out.
That was it, then. We were going to be the point formation on this invasion. I relayed this to my team, and they produced a general chorus of groans.
Okay, people, hustle up. Let's be ready to scramble when we touch down. The second that ramp drops, I want to see nothing but metal tails and dust as you rush out there to surround the lifter.
We didn't have long to wait. The general rule when making any kind of assault from space was to get the flying part over with as quickly as possible. Every second we were in the air increased the odds the lifter would take a hit and wipe out whole units of troops at once. The pilot seemed to be exquisitely aware of this reality. He maneuvered the lifter like it was a dive bomber, taking us down to the deck in a screaming whoop, then pulling up at the last second. A message came from the pilot.
We're about to hit the surface. Crouch your machines and wait it out.
This was a maneuver I'd practiced but never executed under live conditions. To keep upright, our machines could crouch like nesting birds if we wanted them to. We all folded the legs up, just in time. The bottom of the ship shuddered and my teeth rattled. We landed hard, the shocks on our landing struts groaning and bucking. A few of us nosed over and smashed down, and we busied ourselves with pulling one another back up into a standing position. The dragons were top-heavy and not as natural to maneuver as our own bodies, despite our training.
"Gather up whatever you can carry," I ordered. "We don't know what we'll find out there, and we might need just about everything."
I saw troops packing on saddlebags of extra ammo and the like. Then a gray-white line appeared in the hull, and everyone's turret-like head section rotated in that direction.
"First platoon, move out," Graves ordered.
We raced along the aisles and down the broad ramp. It felt good to get out of the lifter. After having watched Pegasus explode, I'd been itching to get out into the open where the ground forces could care for themselves.
"Swing right, McGill," Leeson ordered. "Harris, you take your team with his. Get clear at least 200 meters, then grab cover and park your machines."
We did as he ordered. Leeson himself was the last man of our platoon to exit the ship. He followed us to an outcropping of shiny rock. I couldn't tell if the rock was laced with metal or ice. Maybe it was a little of both. The world itself was a strange one. I'd never been on anything like this place. It was foggy, with swirling gray-white mist everywhere. The place was bone-chillingly cold. I could tell that right off, even though my suit was pretty warm with the engine under my butt heating up. The surface of the planet had a light dusting of what looked like oily snow, which I knew was probably frozen methane. There were rocks and spurs of mineral deposits everywhere. They were stark, and there was no sign of vegetation of any kind.
"What a garden spot," Carlos complained. "Let me guess, this is high summer, right?"
"Shut up, Ortiz," I said.
"But, Vet, where are we going to sleep, inside our suits?"
"We've got tents. We've got insulated gear. We'll be fine."
"Who wants to start a pool on whose waste chute is going to freeze up first?"
I clanked over to him to put a fresh dent in his chassis. I understood as I did it that Harris would have done the same thing for the same reason. He shut up after that, but he buzzed my helmet privately.
"What?" I demanded. "Are you going to be a dick the whole campaign just because you got rank?"
"Carlos, he made a good point. In fact, he made plenty of them. But I need my people to be alertly watching for trouble, not pissing and moaning about the conditions."
"Well, at least you admit I'm right. That's better than Harris ever did."
"Right. Just try to support me by playing it straight, okay?" There was a pause, but he finally answered.
"Will do, Vet. Clearly life is going to be pretty bleak on this snowball. We've got to make the best of it."
I was impressed by his attitude. Maybe asking him nicely and expressing a request in terms of helping the Legion out worked better than just beating on him. I wasn't sure if Harris could have done the same, but that was history. Carlos was my problem now. For about an hour, we patrolled around the lifter and certified that the region was unoccupied. We only found one odd thing during our search. "Command?" I asked, holding up a mystery item with my grippers.
"What do you make of this? Can you read my cameras?"
"Have you got your lights on, McGill?"
Leeson asked.
"Yes. Here, let me defog my camera lenses."
Doing as I proposed was a delicate operation. I couldn't use a gripper for fear of cracking my external lens. Instead, I popped open my suit at the arm, letting it fall down and swing in the wind. My right hand and forearm were thus exposed, but inside a sealed vac suit. I could feel the cold right off. It cut through the thin smart cloth without hesitation. Knowing I didn't have long, I reached out with my barely protected gloved hand and rubbed at the lens. Then I closed the arm and lifted the object in question up to the camera again. "You see it now, sir?" The object was rectangular. It had a corroded case and two metallic knobs protruding from either end of it.
"Yes, I'm passing on the vid to the techs. Looks like some kind of burnt-out battery."
"That's what I was thinking. That's acid leaking from it. To further support the theory, there's a very weak current flowing from the two metal poles."
"Can't be from us," Leeson said. "It's not our design, and it looks too old. That's a mystery, all right, McGill. If it does belong to the squids, it means they must have been here for years. Wouldn't you say it looks like it's been lying out here for a long time?"
"Definitely, sir." The connection broke, and I directed my recon team to pick over the area where we'd found the discarded battery. We found two more like it, also in disrepair. I logged the information and relayed it to command.
"Machines," Carlo said, looking over the third one. "This has to be a discarded battery from a big machine."
I thought about that. But what kind of machine would be wandering around out here? And if it has batteries, how is it recharging them?
"No clue," Carlo said. "Can we go back to camp now?"
We were recalled about an hour later. We headed back to where the units had made camp under the lifter. We had polymer sheets draped down from the bottom of the landing ship to the rocky surface. Inside, the troopers who hadn't been sent out on patrol had been busy building a bivouac. We were grateful for their efforts. Even with the hot engines, the extremities of our machines got cold, especially our metal-encased feet. There was a large area, maybe 200 meters in diameter, which was enclosed, heated, and pressurized. The outer chambers were like airlocks. There we garaged our dragons. The center of the region was almost homey. Condensation dripped from the belly of the lifter some 10 meters over our heads.
"It stinks," Carlos complained.
I didn't argue because he was right. Melted methane, well, that's pretty much what a fart is. We were cautioned against creating any open flame for any reason. Troops grumbled, but they didn't argue. No one wanted to burn their hair off playing with a lighter out here. The combination of warm oxygen from the lifter being pumped in so we could breathe easily, and the melting methane, was a lethal mixture if combustion were to be introduced. "Is this safe, sir?" I asked Leeson when I caught up with him to make my report. "The atmosphere in here, I mean?"
"How the hell do I know?" he asked. "That's up to the bio people in the techs to work out. If I die, though, I hope they revive me without a nose."
I nodded in agreement. Adjunct Leeson was nothing if not a pragmatic man. After some warm food, clean clothes, and a few hours of rest, I was awakened and summoned to an officers' meeting. For a few seconds, I felt my heart race. I'd been summoned to the officers' tent plenty of times in the past. It had almost always been for the express purpose of chewing me out. But not this time. From now on, I was expected to attend command meetings. Veterans were often invited to such affairs. We weren't expected to participate materially in the discussion of strategy, but we had to know what the plan was so we could help execute it. Graves was there with three other Centurions. Another lifter had landed about a kilometer off, and we joined forces. Graves was the senior officer, so he seemed to be in charge. On a makeshift command table in the middle of the group was a flat glowing diagram of the local region. There was a large silver patch directly north of us representing a methane lake. To the east and west were badlands full of gullies and ridges. To the south, however, it looked like a wide open plain.
"We're only about 100 kilometers away from the next grouping of lifters,"
Graves said, zooming out of the map so we could see the bigger picture. I was immediately envious of the other group. There were 6 more lifters there, all clustered up in the valley. Cyclops only had 10 lifters, so most of our troops had to be there. I scanned the map for the rest of the auxiliary cohort, but didn't see it.
Legion Varus is planning to land here, at the main camp, tomorrow morning,
Graves told us.
Since the ships took out the moon base, we've seen no other resistance. The infantry have naturally chosen to reinforce Winslade at his largest concentration, making that our beachhead.
Frowning, I almost raised my hand. I managed to stop myself in the nick of time, and I was proud of that. To my relief, an adjunct beat me to the punch and asked the question I had rattling around in my head.
Sir, why don't we just get back aboard the lifter and fly there?
That's exactly what we're going to do, when our current mission is finished, that is.
The adjunct looked confused, and I joined him. Graves continued with a sigh.
We've been ordered to mount a rescue effort first. Remember Legion Solstice? The survivors abandoned Pegasus. They're scattered to the north of us, just past this big lake.
How many, sir? Asked the adjunct.
About 2,000 of them.
The adjunct whistled. I grimaced and gnawed at my lower lip. Thousands? That was a lot of troops, and they were probably spread out over a large area. All of us were wondering if it might not be better to let them and their equipment go and churn fresh troops out of the revival machines.
These men are the last of Legion Solstice,
Graves said, reading our expressions.
They're still alive, so we can't just write them off and revive them. Accordingly, we're going out there to render assistance. They've reported encountering some kind of mechanized resistance at their location. They're avoiding further radio transmissions, claiming it attracts danger of some sort.
Danger? What kind of danger?
Blurted Adjunct Mesa. Graves gave the adjunct a stare. He swallowed and apologized.
We don't know,
Graves answered finally.
They've suffered casualties. They're spread out and unable to form a nice cozy camp like this. I asked if we could bring the lifters over to pick them up, but the request was denied. Command doesn't want to risk losing more of our assault vehicles.
Command meant Winslade, I thought to myself. I couldn't help but notice he didn't mind risking his cavalry, just the lifters he needed to get back off this rock. That was typical for any officer, but the ruthless ones were worse than the others. They valued expensive equipment more than human flesh.
This is where we get into the game, troops,
Graves said, standing up and raising his voice.
We'll ride to the rescue in the morning. And by the way, this is a fast-rotating planet, so night is only about 9 hours long. Get to bed as soon as you can.
We broke up and headed to our bedrolls, which were alien-made products especially designed for humanoids suffering in cold climates.
You know what the quartermaster told me?
Carlos asked as we bedded down. I didn't answer, but he kept going as if I had.
These sleeping bags are made from alien spider silk. They can keep you warm down to -200°C, and they weigh less than a kilo. Perfect for troops on icy shitholes like this one.
Thanks for the infomercial, Carlos. Now let's get some sleep. He finally shut up, and I was left to ponder Graves' words. What had he said? Something about Solstice having encountered some kind of mechanized resistance? I had to wonder what that was all about. But I didn't wonder for long. I was snoring within 3 minutes after sliding into my toasty, warm spider silk bag. The bag was nice, and it had me jealous of all those bugs who died in cocoons like this one. I'd never known what I'd been missing. Chapter 13. In the morning, we saddled up our dragons. We had some tough choices to make regarding loadouts. These walking death dealers were much more advanced than the one that Turov had used to such great effect aboard Minotaur back on Tech World, and they came with optional equipment. Even the armament had a variety of configurations. You could pack on extra generators, which gave the machine a shorter recharge time and more hours of running around, or you could take along extra ammo for the chest guns instead. Another option was to adopt a more defensive arrangement, which meant about an inch of electromagnetic shielding that covered the hull, protecting the system from small arms and the like. Yet another choice involved a longer-range gun system that rode on the spine of the vehicle and fired right over your shoulder. "How should we do this, Adjunct?" I asked Leeson. "What kind of..."